Okay. It always feels when I talk about Buddhist takes on mortality, this is such a young sangha. It feels so very goth of me. Like I'm like, I should be dressed up like Robert Smith, and you know, should have The Cure playing behind me, and or Dead Can Dance. And I understand that the concept or the important talking about the importance of reflecting on mortality, especially when people are in their 30s, can seem like a very distant or it can feel like not the most important thing to bear in mind. It can feel even a little bit distant, but there's a number of reasons why for certainly any age, the reflections on the mortality of the body is important. First of all, because it's very easy in life to just keep putting off our true happiness into the future, to get caught up in careers, relationships, families, art, all of which can be really wonderful sources of worldly pleasures. But down the line, when it comes time to both facing our own mortality and the mortality of others, all the time and effort we've spent putting into worldly things will not be very helpful when it comes to dealing face to face with these more finite and starker events that we all have to face. We all have to, as the Buddha said, and as monks reflect every day, there's the five daily reflections. I am of the nature to grow old. I am of the nature to become sick. I am of the nature to die. All that I hold dear, I will be separated from. And finally, all that I own are the results of my actions. That's all that I have. The first four can seem very, very dark and scary. Most people don't like thinking about death, because obviously, first of all, there's a fear that, you know, we don't know where it's going to come, when it's going to come, how it's going to come. More so, I think people have a sort of budding awareness that the priorities in our lives are sometimes, maybe not majorly, but sometimes a little askew, that we're prioritizing maybe a career or something else entirely, and that we're not putting in any real time towards reflecting on this important issue, what it means to us, how we'll prepare for it, how we prepare for, you know, the loss of others, how it should affect our practice today and the way we live today. So there's this budding awareness that maybe we haven't done any, that we've been putting it off, that we haven't been looking at it, and that can feel a little bit tense, a little bit uncomfortable. And then there's also the fear that we won't have anything, there's a fear that we might not have anything available to us that will keep us strong and secure and stable and calm when we are faced with sickness or faced with issues of mortality. It can be unsettling, and most people can spend entire lives just not thinking about it, in the hopes, I guess, that we'll be the exception to the rule. even though in the hundreds of billions of people that have lived on this planet, so far nobody, well, people say that one person succeeded, but even then the odds are not very good. So, so the odds are a little stark to hope to be the exception to the rule, and so it is actually an important thing to start when somebody enters Buddhist practice in traditional Buddhist cultures. These reflections are very much practiced on a daily basis. The first four are just saying the truth, which is we are of the nature, because we exist inside of a bag of skin and bones and organs and whatnot. It is a statement of truth that we will grow old, we will experience sickness, death, and we will be separated from things we love. Part of what happens in old age is the senses become duller. Things don't become as crisp. Our ability to perceive the world diminishes. So there's a letting go of our contact with everything, that all the sources of happiness outside. And very much in the practice of traditional Buddhist cultures, there's not only the reciting of these five truths, but there's also the reciting of every day. They recite the supposed 33 parts of the body where they envision it, like the spleen and the kidney. And the idea is to understand that we are very much composed of all these different parts. And if that any of them start to fail, we can fail. So that we first of all develop an appreciation for what we have. Sometimes in life we can get so beat up and so fucked over by somebody saying something we don't like, or, you know, somebody not liking our band or whatever we're doing, you know. That motherfucker didn't like my independent movie. Whatever the fuck you're up to, I don't know, but it's very tempting to get bent out of shape. But if we have a sense of appreciation for just how unbelievable it is that we have all these interlocking parts that are actually not only contributing to a breathing, living body, but then on top of that we all have relative, and we're stretching it here, but relative sanity, right? Because there's so many different ways when you study the brain. There's so many different, very, very intricate balancing of neurotransmitters and receptors. And if any of it goes slightly off, it can very well knock us entirely off. Any possibility of finding inner peace and happiness and constructive engagement with the world. So it's pretty much very fortuitous that we have all these things that we have. And it's important to reflect on that. Now, when the Buddha was teaching, a Brahmin named Janusan came to him, and Janusan said, "Yo, man." He didn't literally say that, but I'm translating it for you, because the Pali is pretty fucking dense. But anyway, he said basically, there isn't any human being that isn't frightened of death. And the Buddha said, well, actually, there's four reasons that people are terrified of death, and there's four reasons that they can be relieved of this terror. The first, I'll give them quickly, the first is being attached to the body for both its beauty or its sense of identity that it gives us. The second is being attached to all the external pleasures that we have developed. Praise, approval, acclaim from our jobs, from our relationships, the things that we own, the things that we accumulate, the money we have, a sense of, you know, having a lot of friends on Facebook, etc. We have all these things that give us a sense of I'm important and I'm loved and I'm appreciated. And that's the second thing. We if we're really overbalanced towards that, then letting go of that is extremely painful. And the person who is really attached to those approval, the sense of, I get my sense of being okay from outside in the world, then the whole process of aging is very scary. Likewise, he said, somebody who's acted harmfully in his life, somebody who's wasted his life being self-centered and has been acting only in his self-interest, and when the time comes cannot bring to mind the pleasure of having done good for others. And the fourth is somebody who's never experienced true peace within through having a spiritual practice that allows them to cultivate a sense of serenity within, no matter what's going on with that. And of course, that's really important when it comes to the stages that we're talking about. So the first, and then of course the opposite is true. Somebody who hasn't been overly attached to the body, who hasn't been overly attached to sensual or external pleasures, so somebody who hasn't been extremely self-centered and has been giving and compassionate and kind, and somebody who has developed peace within will not be terrified of the stages of old age, sickness, and death. Why is that? Well, let's look at the first. If we're really attached to our bodies, and I think my body is who I am, then when it starts to age, and I assure you it has, you know, when I start seeing the signs of it not being able to do what it used to be able to do, when it, you know, injuries come easier, when, you know, there's all the various physical manifestations of aging, it's going to be very upsetting to me, because then I'm going to think the I, myself, is getting old. If my entire identity or my sense of who I am is based on this shell that I'm living in. So that can be very disturbing. On the other hand, if I have let go of that attachment, that identity source from my body, then I understand that even if my body goes, there's still a sense of who I am, or a sense of a me-ness that doesn't have to be diminished or dying off simply because the body is. So somebody, for example, who is prematurely paralyzed due to an accident, their entire minds, their sense of consciousness, their goodness, their generosity, their intelligence, their sense of humor doesn't have to go anywhere. It doesn't mean that they have suddenly diminished. You wouldn't go to somebody who's in a wheelchair and say, oh, you've diminished yourself. You're somehow less the person than you were. Nobody would ever do that. But yet, when we are in a body that begins to age, we tend to think, I'm really getting old here. So there's this importance to detach from this idea that the body fabric is who I am, it's where I get my pleasure from, it's where I get my happiness from. The second is attachment to things in the world, especially to our careers, our jobs, our families, and they're all wonderful things. And we're not renunciates. Nobody here is being asked to, or we're never. The suggestion is not to quit your jobs or anything like that. But the goal is to rebalance so that we have some, for lack of a better term, we have the ability to focus on whatever is important to us in the world, but there's also other important endeavors that are developing for us sources of happiness for the future. Because if my sense of happiness is entirely contingent upon getting approval from you from my art, there's going to come a day when it's not going to be available to me. If my sense of who I am and my happiness comes from my work, my career, there's going to come a time when I'm not going to be able to do that. Careers come and go in an instant. And I've seen a couple of times in my life financial bubbles that lead to bursts where people one moment are extremely powerful and very puffed up on their careers, and then the next moment they have nothing. But also, even if it doesn't happen that way, there comes a time in everybody's career where it just becomes absurd when you creak into the office and they go, oh, there's Bob. Oh, I hope I'm not like him crawling in here, and, you know. And even if you want to do that, if that's the sole way you're getting your happiness, it's fine if you want to go in there all the time, but if you're not getting any source of inner peace elsewhere, then the moment that work becomes unavailable, then happiness goes. And you can expand this out with family. Some people think that their family is going to be their source of happiness. And of course, there's always a surprise. The kids wind up having their own lives. They don't call or visit as much as they should. Even if they do visit as much as possible, it might not be enough. It won't be enough, because still we have to deal with aging, death, basically on our own. There's nobody who can make it go away for us. And of course, if we've hardwired the mind with really self-centered thoughts about how I'm, other people, I need to take care of myself, that's the way it works, then that thinking will have been hardwired into the mind when we reach ages and times and periods in our lives, when we really will not benefit from having those thoughts be the ones that jump up at us. When it will become time to ask for help, when it will become time to open up with our sense of frailty and our insecurity, if all we've been doing is cultivating a sense of me against the world, or other people's problems are their own, I don't have to pay attention, so I'm just taking care of number one, that basically is a sabotaging approach later on, when we will need to be open about what we're going through, when we will need a sense of being able to connect, at least at times when we need physical support, when we need a sense of moral support, a sense of community. The most important is the cultivation of a sense of inner peace within through practicing being extremely well, before I go there, I just want to say that what we can develop instead is to develop a generosity and a compassion and a kindness. And those thoughts and actions, if we do act out on them and we cultivate them later on, those feelings and having practiced them will really create a state of peace and a state that our lives have been worthwhile. There was that study that I love to quote where they gave people $10 and they told half the people to spend it on themselves and half to spend it on a stranger. And the ones that spent the $10 on themselves within a couple of months couldn't remember what they did with it, felt no boost in self-esteem or any sense of generosity. But the people who were told to spend the $10 on someone else felt both, A, they could remember exactly what they spent it on, who they gave it to, why, and they could still feel good about it. So generosity is, and kindness and compassion are mind states that really resonate and can give us a sense of peace that the opposite mind states can. So the last one is developing inner peace, and it's it comes from cultivating real patience and a sense of kindness and with ourselves, looking in and relaxing the body and the breath, taking care of ourselves, developing a source of tranquility that comes from being able to focus the mind. The Buddha said that this state of inner peace is what he called a state of, he gave it a lot of names, but Nibbana, the whole goal of lasting peace, he said a couple of things about it. He said that it was apara, which means that it's limitless, it's unconditional, it's always available. No matter what happens to you physically, no matter what happens to you financially, no matter how few friends we wind up with, we always will have this available to us. It is unconditional. And then he also said it's amara, which means that it's deathless. This source of inner tranquility, which we develop in our practice, does not die. It doesn't go away. Everything else might be taken from us, but this inner source of peace will always be available to us because it doesn't, again, require money, external things. It's totally based on focusing inwards and cultivating a practice that's based on patience and generosity and compassion with ourselves, with our inner experience, with working with the breath to ease the mind. For example, when we breathe really deeply in the chest, we trip what's known as the vagus nerve, which triggers what's known as the parasympathetic nervous system, which calms us down and makes us feel peaceful. When the breath is really fast and shallow, it triggers the sympathetic nervous system, which releases cortisol and makes us anxious and worried. So simply the way we breathe can change the way we feel. And relaxing the rest of the body participates as well. The Buddha said that when we looked for our happiness in fantasies or memories, these are what he called sankharas. They're fabrications. And fabrications have two problems to them. The first is they're completely at odds with reality. If we're sitting there in a crummy job and we're fantasizing about being on the stage of Madison Square Garden, and then somebody comes up and says, hey, did you enter that data or whatever? And then your fucking fantasy is fucking blown. It fucking sucks. And that is the same with fantasies and memories. They can go poof like that the moment somebody pokes you or says something or, you know, anything in reality happens, and bang, that fantasy or that memory is gone. So relying on fantasies and memories to keep us happy in old age is not going to be the ticket. Because we're always going to wake up out of that matrix-like, you know, imagination that we build for ourselves, and there'll be the well, in the Matrix, you're in a pod with this machine, having a geek moment. You're in some pod, and they're sucking at your life. But hopefully it's not that bad. Hopefully we'll be in a nursing home that won't be quite that dark. But but you never know. When we develop peace within, though, through meditation, it's not something that can be knocked away. I've actually been meditated through very stressful events, and simply knowing what's out there doesn't stop me from keeping the body calm, the breath deep, myself relaxed. The more practice we have, the more we can stay calm and serene during amazing events. I know one monk who was operated on without any anesthesia on his kidney simply by having his practice. He was well aware that he was being operated on, but he had an ability to simply distinguish the source of pleasure from the pain that was going on. And, well, it's not going to come to that for you, I hope, but I mean, but the point is that if you have a meditation practice, you have something that you know, somebody pokes you and says, hey, what's going on? You're not going to be, ah! You can still remain peaceful. You can still have a sense of calm and a sense of inner security. It's not vulnerable. So, I'm going to close by leading to reading the three reflections that that Buddhists use, especially monks use, to working daily with the concept of mortality. After they do the five reflections, which are, I'm of nature to grow old, become sick, die, all that is dear to me I was separated from, and all that I own are the results of my actions. And the fifth one, again, is the good news. First four kind of suck, but the fifth is the good news. It says that if I act through peaceful, skillful means, I will get to live in that mind. I will get to live in a peaceful mind. Neurons that fire together, wire together. That's what neuroscientists have shown us. If we think peaceful thoughts, compassionate thoughts, we live in a peaceful, compassionate mind in the future. We're planting the mind we live in by the actions and the thoughts we think right now. We're planting our future mind states. That's what karma is. So there are the three reflections or recollections that help work with the reflection of mortality. So the reflection of virtues goes like this. If on this day or in the past I have done good, here I call to mind those deeds and let my heart rejoice in that feeling. I rejoice in my own good deeds, resolving not to compare myself with others or speak of what I have done. I rejoice in my own good deeds and gladly share my joy with all beings everywhere. Now that's a recollection of virtue, which means simply that when we're faced with loss or we're faced with a sense of really devastating news, we bring to mind the generosity, the compassion we've shown, so that we're creating an inner state of feeling that life has been spent usefully, has been worthwhile, that we've had a positive effect. A second version of that is the reflection on generosity. Have I begrudged sharing whatever abundance I enjoy, or have I delighted in giving without greed? I will give not just to those I like, but to strangers and to foes. I will give being mindful of the needs of others. I will give humbly without a desire for recognition. I will give and let others give to me. I will give knowing that generosity brings peace and frees the heart. Notice that it says, I give without desire for recognition, but I will let others give to me if they want. What that means is, very often in life, people give with the express purpose or point of being able to tell someone else that they gave. And that's not giving. That's advertising. If I give money and a wing of a hospital names like I have any money, but if I had money and I gave it to a hospital, they name a wing after me, that's advertising. I'm paying for them to put my name up there to make people think that I'm a good person. So that's not generosity. On the other hand, if I give without any expectation of getting anything back, just for the feeling of that I've done something good that comes from within, then the rewards don't come from out there. They're not conditional upon anyone else seeing it. And the more I make my actions unconditional upon you, but just learn to develop a sense of feeling good about myself because I've done something, then we're less contingent upon others to make us feel okay. We've developed the skill through practice of feeling good about ourselves without needing other people to be the source of it. We're no longer contingent on approval. If you've ever been contingent, your happiness been contingent upon approval, you'll know that it sucks. Because no matter if you really like it when people like your art or the work you're doing, then you've noticed by now that sometimes they don't like it. And that kind of fucking sucks, right? But on the other hand, if you've developed the capacity to do something virtuous and not need approval, not need recognition from someone else, then you have developed a skill that means no matter what it is you do, if it's beneficial, you will feel a sense of ease, a sense of fullness, a sense of purpose, a sense of pride. And no one can take that away from you because it didn't come from anyone. So finally, the reflection on death itself. Some of the writing in here is extraordinarily beautiful, so I'm going to read it. Occasionally I've translated it a little bit, but it's a very beautiful reflection. I sit now and contemplate that the Buddha and all who knew him are now dead. And since his time, countless beings have come and gone. The names of but a few are remembered. Their victories and defeats, like themselves, are but shadows. And so it will be with all whom I know. May I understand what is of true value in this life. And so I intend the following. Here's where the intentions begin. I will repay my debts and forgive the transgressions of others so that I will be at odds with no one. And if you're in a 12-step community, that should sound pretty familiar. I will waste no time brooding on past mistakes, but use each day as if it were my last. I will purify my mind rather than excessively pamper the body. I will develop compassion rather than possessiveness and clinging. And may my awareness help in the freeing of the heart. So the idea summarizes all that we've talked about earlier, that through generosity, compassion, kindness, by not attaching to the body or upset or overbalancing to our careers, that we can develop skills that will help us in the future when we need them. Again, this is simply rebalancing. At no point does it mean to give up any of your endeavors in the world, but it means to take some time, when it's available, to take some time so that you cultivate tools that even if today might not be as needed as they will be in the future, just have faith that one day you will need to have a source of inner peace and calmness. You will one day need to have a source of feeling that your life was spent helping others to a degree. You will need to not overly attach to the body, and you will need to be able to let go of all the things in the world because a lot of them will be taken. So I thank you for listening. I hope there was something of value in there, and now it's your turn to share anything that comes to mind.